in Matthew's Gospel. Continuing our series in the Sermon on the Mount, we read in Matthew 6 and from the 19th verse. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. May God seal his word to our minds and to our hearts. To the passage we read earlier in Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, and we are concerned this evening with verses 9 to 24. And I want to begin by asking, what are the things on which we place the greatest value? Now, I know it's easy to give a trite answer to that question, or perhaps to answer in the way in which we know we are expected to answer it. Nevertheless, the real answer of our lives to that question is of crucial importance. In chapter 6, Jesus has been leading us through some of the snares that affect the Christian life. In verse 1 to 18, he has unpacked the danger of hypocrisy, of putting on a religious show with regard to three spiritual disciplines, our giving, our prayer life, and fasting. In verses 9 to 24, Jesus goes on to outwork the danger of materialism. And in verses 25 to 34, he addresses the danger of anxiety. And it's the second group of dangers that we are concerned with this evening. The danger of materialism. There is perhaps no section in the Sermon on the Mount that requires our attention today as much as this one. For we in the Western world have in great measure capitulated to its influence. And I want you to notice that in these verses, Jesus' teaching in this passage employs three sets of contrasts. And the first of these, in verses 19 to 21, is a contrast of treasures. A contrast of treasures. Earthly treasure is contrasted with heavenly treasure. And in order to understand what Jesus means by earthly treasure, we need to be clear about what he is not saying. He is not saying that the possession of wealth is intrinsically wrong and that therefore we must get rid of all of our possessions. The spirit of materialism is something that can influence the poorest of men, so that simply taking a vow of poverty and expelling all of the material possessions from our lives is not the solution to the problem. Nor is Jesus teaching here that to make provision for one's future is wrong. This understanding of the passage has caused some, I know, to be dismissive of pension funds, health and life insurance policies, and for that matter, having any money in the bank at all. In 1 Timothy 5 and 8, we find Paul dealing with this misunderstanding, and he writes, "If anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Nor do we find Jesus is teaching here that we are to despise the material world that surrounds us, that we are to hate the material things that we see in everyday life. This is certainly a view that began to creep into the early church, and one which we find Paul again refuting in 1 Timothy chapter 4. And from the third verse, he's speaking of those who have crept into the church and they forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, because it is consecrated by the word of God and prayer. What then lies at the heart of Jesus' concern? Well, we need to begin by reminding ourselves that when God completed his material creation, he declared all that he surveyed as good. That was God's judgment on the material creation. Now, when man sinned, many of the things that God created for man's benefit became the unhealthy focus of his love. And he made these very things the source of his satisfaction, so that his satisfaction and his treasure took on a temporal rather than an eternal quality. So that when Jesus said, "Where a man's treasure is, there his heart is also," he was making a distinction between two types of men. Think first of all of the man who confines his ambitions and his interests and his hopes to this world only. He is more concerned about improving his material condition than with anything else. More important than worship. He has failed to make a proper use of the good things that God has provided him with. And I'm sure it's true that we have all of us felt the pull, have we not, of this world's values. It is with good cause that Jim Elliot prayed these words, "Father, Let me be weak that I may lose my clutch on everything temporal. My life, my reputation, my possessions. Lord, let me lose the tension of the grasping hand. And the more we gather possessions in order to feel secure, the more we feel we need them in order to be secure. And then the more we need to guard them in order to maintain that security. Therefore, the less secure we feel. It really is a vicious circle. Now we've heard, have we not, again and again, that wealth cannot buy happiness. And in these verses, Jesus explains why this should be. Happiness depends upon lasting wealth. What do we sing? Solid joys and lasting treasure. And of course, the folly of materialism is that it offers no lasting treasure. One is concerned about the fascination with prosperity in some areas of the Christian church, and the encouragement to see material prosperity as a chief indicator of the blessing of God. And one hears that teaching again and again and again. But it fails to take Jesus' teaching seriously at this point. Real spirituality is not seen in gathering in material wealth, but in being delivered from loving it, whether we have it or not. That is Jesus' concern. On the positive side, Jesus is advocating the pursuit of heavenly treasure. And Jesus' argument in favor of pursuing this treasure is powerfully compelling. Earthly treasure has a short life expectancy, argues Jesus. Look at Matthew 6 and 19 with this in mind. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. Now you may well want to argue that today we have insecticides, we have rust proofing and burglar alarms, but we also have inflation and devaluation and one economic crisis after another. The point Jesus is making in these verses is this, that by way of contrast, heavenly treasure is absolutely secure. But what is heavenly treasure? You will notice that Jesus does not expand upon it here, but other passages in Scripture fill out his meaning. First of all, we can lay up treasure in heaven by developing Christian character. If you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and we read there from verse 10 following. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each should be careful how he builds. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation using gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is. Because the day, that is the day of judgment, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it is burned up, he will suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. Quite simply, what Paul is teaching in this passage is that that which is worked into our lives down here, Christian character, gold, silver, precious stones, will be reflected up there. Secondly, we send treasure on ahead of us by the use of the talents God has given us in our lives, in Christian service. And the parable of the talents is used by Jesus to illustrate that. I know the talents that he spoke of referred to monetary sums, but by extension the teaching is applicable. What we have been entrusted with by God and how we use that will be taken into consideration by him in the assessment of reward in glory. Incidentally, when a man is delivered from grasping and maintaining his status in the world, it's then and only then that he discovers a freedom to serve others. Our service will also take on a particular focus. It will be for God's glory and have as its aim, through our prayer and by our witness, seeing others brought to faith in Christ Jesus. Paul gives us some insight into his own pursuit of treasure, writing to the church at Philippi in Philippians 4 and verse 1, where he reminds the church, "You are my crown. You are my crown." As a result of my preaching, as the result of the gospel having its effect in your lives, you came to Christ. And that is treasure. "You are my crown," he says. But we also make a heavenly deposit when we use our material wealth in the promotion of Christ's kingdom. And again, Paul draws Timothy's attention to this in 1 Timothy chapter 6. And from the 17th verse, he says, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share." What kind of treasure are we building up? Are we more concerned with our balance in the Halifax Building Society or equivalent, or with our balance in heaven? Where your heart is, there your treasure is also. Let me ask you these questions. What do you dream about? What is it that occupies your mind and your thinking? Where your heart is, there your treasure is also. Moving on to the second of the three sets of contrasts that Jesus establishes in this passage, we think of two visions. The type of treasure we are building up will very much depend upon whether we are a people with a clear or a distorted vision. And Jesus introduces this idea in verses 22 to 23. The eye of the lamp, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now these verses are concerned with spiritual perception. The eye is regarded in this figure of speech by Jesus as the window through which light enters into the whole body. And the colour and state of the window decides what light gets into the room. If the window is clear, the light will come flooding in. If the glass is dirty and obscure, then the room will not be lit up. Now, Jesus' point is the amount of light that gets into a man's soul is related to his spiritual perception. Now, you will know that diseased eyesight affects more than the eyes. The greater tragedy, says Jesus, is that the whole body is full of darkness. So it is with our heart. Poor spiritual vision, having the wrong spiritual priorities, influences the entire direction of our lives. How do we account for the fact that some people can't really see beyond amassing material wealth? Quite simply, they have spiritual cataracts in their eyes. Their vision of God has been clouded. The deceitfulness of wealth is obscuring spiritual truth, spiritual insight, which they may once have had. Such a person's life is marked by spiritual darkness. Now, this type of individual can quite easily amass a fortune by inhuman or ruthless means, and then turn around and say, "I see nothing wrong or dishonest with that." Their whole body is full of darkness. Selfish material ambition plunges men into moral darkness, and that distorts their vision. In contrast, the man who has a single-minded ambition to serve God adds meaning to his life and throws light on everything he does. He sees other individuals not as pawns to be used and manipulated in the pursuit of his ambition for material possessions. Rather, he sees other individuals as men and women in need of the gospel of Christ. And his longing is to see a world of men and women won for Christ. His ambition reflects that of Paul's, longing to see others converted that he might say, "You are my crown." How do we see other people? Do we see them as stepping stones? Do we see them as pawns to be used to advance the desires of our hearts? Or do we see them as those on whom God has placed great value? And do we long to see the redeeming grace of God at work in their lives? Two treasures, two visions. This brings us to the third contrast. Jesus makes it abundantly clear that no man can serve two masters. We will serve one of two masters: either God or wealth. Now, I know that men and women can become quite indignant when it is suggested to them that they may well have become the slaves of things. Who, a slave? Me, a slave? They do not like to be challenged by the possibility that things that have been created to serve them have somehow or other exchanged roles and made them their servants. I'm sure we are all familiar with the way in which an obsessive desire for material gain can cause people to act in quite shameful ways. Of a mother who neglects her children because she's out at the bingo every night in the week. She has this dream of winning a fortune. Or the father whose hope of a better life rides on a lottery ticket. Someone was telling me in the course of the week that they were in the post office, and a fellow with his pension just paid out, purchased a handful of lottery tickets because he had this dream of winning a fortune. Or think of the man whose world collapses around him because somebody had the temerity to steal his stamp collection. And all his life he had been building up this marvelous collection, and it's gone. Or the woman who has no peace of mind because she simply cannot find the correct shade of three-piece suite to set off her lounge. Now, you laugh at that. But there are people who behave in precisely that way. The Lord of materialism is able to creep into every aspect of our lives. People have sometimes asked me why there is not the same overt opposition to the gospel in this country, or indeed in many of the Western countries, as one finds in the Middle East or in Africa or in parts of Central Asia. And to my mind, the answer is quite simple. Materialism by itself is doing a great job of arresting the progress of the church. And Satan does not need to employ less subtle means. C.S. Lewis was thinking along these lines in his Screwtape Letters. And in these letters, he describes a senior tempter advising a junior in the following manner. Don't waste time trying to make your subject believe materialism is true. Make him think it is strong and stark and courageous. And that is certainly what the advertising executives in the West have made us believe. They have made us believe that there is a certain status connected to what we possess. Isn't it true that we no longer get rid of products because they are worn out or broken, but because they are no longer fashionable? If we do not have this year's colours, or the very latest modifications on a piece of equipment, then we're not truly happy. I remember hearing of a family discuss changes they were about to make, a Christian family, changes they were about to make in their home. And they had a green toilet suite which fitted in perfectly well, and they thought, well, we're fed up with that colour. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not broken, it's not cracked. It's not old, it's been in a couple of years, but we would like a different colour this year, and this year's colour is peach, and so we would like a peach toilet suite. We end up all too easily as puppets dancing to the tune of material things, enslaved by material things rather than free men enjoying fellowship with the God who has redeemed us to himself and liberated us for service. There are, of course, people who believe that it is possible to have the best of both worlds. There are always people who want the best of both worlds and who seek to adopt a philosophy of compromise. They will serve two masters, God on Sunday, wealth during the week, or God with their lips, wealth with their hearts. Christian moonlighting is a practice that many have decided to adopt without realizing the direction in which Christian moonlighting carries them. And Jesus makes it quite clear in our passage that no man can serve two masters. And the illustration that he uses presents, as you will notice, with the picture of a slave and not that of an employee. Now, it is quite possible for a man to work for two different employers. Some here may well have done that at some stage in their life. But no slave can be the property of two owners. For single ownership and full-time service are the very essence of slavery. And the person who tries to divide his loyalty between God and his possessions has already yielded to his possessions, since God can only be served with an entire and an exclusive devotion. And it is essential for the sake of our spiritual well-being that the question of the devotion of our hearts be settled once and for all. Who has our heart's devotion? Have we resolved that? issue. Jesus' teaching can be reduced to this simple axiom: either God owns our possessions and we serve him, or our possessions own us and we serve them. This is the choice facing us at its most basic. The story is told of a farmer who had two calves, one red, one white. And he told his wife that it was his intention to devote one of these calves to the Lord's work. Though he said it was not important at that point in time to specify which of the two calves was for God's work. Both were reared in exactly the same way, and they were to be sold in the market, and the proceeds of one of the sales would go to God. It all seemed so very simple and straightforward. Then one morning the farmer came into his wife with what he described as bad news. God's calf had died. And his wife reminded him that they had not yet decided upon which calf belonged to God. "Oh no," he said, "I intended all along that it was the red calf that was God's calf, and it's the red one that sadly has died." God's calf always dies when we try to serve both God and wealth. When money becomes difficult, the first thing we are persuaded to economize on is God's work. What a searching test that is to our hearts. Two treasures, two visions, and finally, we have examined two masters. This teaching of Jesus is of tremendous importance in our own materialistic age. Jesus asks three simple questions: where is your treasure? Where is your vision focused? Who is your master? The questions are simple, but the answers that we give will have a profound influence upon how we live our lives. And you will discover that the world in which we live offers all too inadequate alternatives. Alternatives which promise to enrich, promise to empower and liberate our lives, but they have the effect of impoverishing, weakening, and enslaving us. May God help us, therefore, to make the right choices and to constantly and continually give to him the wholehearted devotion of our heart, so that our lives will be seen to declare to the world that we are citizens of another kingdom. May God seal his word to our hearts.